welcome to the Such Nerds podcast. Tonight we have season four's finale, wrapping up Foundation's Edge. I am your host for tonight, the beautiful, the fantastic, the alpha and the omega, Peter, along with my other co-hosts.
Jason from Florida.
And Dan from Los Angeles.
And we have a very special guest returning tonight, the fantastic, the season one finale co-host, Brent. Say hello to everybody, Brent.
Well, hi, everybody, and thanks for the amazing introduction. My mom is going to be really impressed, although she's not really going to know who you're talking about. So I am here in Connecticut, and I am a former colleague of Jason's. In fact, I am the reason that Jason got a new job and moved to Florida and living in the bug-filled swamps.
Allegedly living in Florida. Mm-hmm. He could be broadcasting from 10,000 leagues under the sea.
Hypothetically.
We don't actually know where Jason is.
You never know.
We know where he claims to be. We don't know where he is.
Tune in every week to find out what part of the Western Hemisphere he is. It's like Carmen Sandiego, this guy. Well,
at one point he was, you know, maybe on Mars. So at least we're back on Earth.
But it doesn't matter where I am, Peter, because I'm here with you guys tonight making this happen, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, you can barely notice the satellite delay in your conversations.
Yeah, you must be near Earth orbit, probably, not too far outside. Well, welcome, Brent. Welcome back. It's great to have you.
And I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I'm surprised we didn't scare you off after the first round.
Well, there were no lawsuits or police investigations, so I figured it was safe. The statute of limitations has probably expired.
That's great. Yeah, so no one ever came and talked to you about Russ's mysterious disappearance?
No, there was nothing about that or anything about the missing money and shall we say product inventory.
Excellent.
You know, I'd just like to remind you, Brent, that you know, you are the first co-host to return, and I just want to make sure that you remember the terms of your non-disclosure agreement about where you've been for the past 2 years to protect the innocent, Fifth Amendment, all that good stuff.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, I'm sure that my employer and my girlfriend, neither one of them really want to know the details.
That's right. And that's why Brent is going to be taking the new position as bag man in my religious organization.
I always wanted to grow up to be a crooked televangelist.
PHQ.
Dan is spearheading our West Coast operation, and Jason is still currently on the run from our last entanglement.
Setting up the southeastern branch.
Now they've been sending out alerts, and the sheep are nervous.
Good. That's how we like them. They're easier to control when they're scared.
Oh, you are so bad.
Oh, nice.
Fantastic.
Who had 622 for first sheep pun? I don't know. That might be a little early.
It was a little bit early, but that's okay. Well, let's get this season started. And by season, I mean wrapped up.
And by season, I mean wrapped up.
By season, I mean episode. And by started, I mean wrapped up.
That's right. You got it.
And by summary,
season, I mean started.
So, Dan, as always, do you have a fantastic summary for us?
Do you have a collection of words that may or may not describe the book that we just read? Well, I do. Well, thank you for asking.
Fantastic. Let's kick it off, because you are the master of summaries.
Golden Terese, a brash freshman, first Foundation councilman, is exiled from Terminus for treason, proclaiming that Harry Seldon's analysis made 500 years earlier matches the current situation too perfectly to be authentic. Trevise and an older companion, Professor Yanov Pelerad, are ostensibly to search the great library on Tranter for information on the mythical planet Earth Gaia, while in fact, Trevise is to locate the Second Foundation, which Brando believes is manipulating the plan. She is unaware that Tranter is home to the Second Foundation, and that Councilman Munley Compor, Trevise's betrayer, whom she orders to follow him as a Second Foundation agent managed by the ambitious Second Foundation speaker, Stor Jendabal. Jendabal, too, believes that some mentalic force is tinkering with the Seldon plan, but before he can share his analysis with the table, he is waylaid by a Hamishman, rescued by a Hamish woman, and impeached by his colleagues. Surinobi's smooth mind proves that someone has been tinkering with exquisite subtlety. Jendabal is acquitted and sent to investigate Trevise, taking Novi along as mental early warning system. Trevise pilots the advanced Farstar to Seychelles, where they learn the few facts and many myths around Gaia and decide on a risky visit. Trevise is put off by the Gaian's claims of sharing a common mind, and particularly by Pelerat falling in love with a young Gaian Bliss. She accompanies him into orbit, where they must face off with the first and second Foundation spaceships, and Trevise is told he must use his intuition to decide among three alternate plans for the welfare of humanity. Trevise uses the Galaxia plan because it alone has a long-range framework allowing modification and correction. Determined to resume his search for Earth, Trevise is concerned that Pellerat wants to remain behind, having fallen in love with Bliss. Trevise intuits that she is a robot and confronts her, securing a promise to be good to the kindly old professor.
Well, that was pretty good. I'd just like to point out for our audience that Dan successfully did that in seven breaths, which is, you know, in accordance with the samurai code. So,
yes, barely.
Also, is it a young guy named Bliss or a young Guyan?
Guyan,
got it.
Who knows? You never know.
Yeah,
she could be putting on airs.
I want to object to the characterization of Professor Pellerat as elderly, because I think in the novel it says he's about 54. In other words, younger than me. So watch where you tread there.
It doesn't say he's elderly, does it?
Well, you said he was elderly just now. The book didn't.
He's old in spirit. He does not have the same pep.
Well, you know.
Yeah. I didn't realize the plants had names. I was like, oh, there's like, I thought it was like ABC. You said the Galaxian plan? Was that what it was called?
Yeah, I don't know if they
It was called Galaxia, was the idea of forming this, omniscient, conscious, everything.
Yeah, it's basically like the first foundation, second foundation, or third foundation. And the Gaian plan is a third foundation plan. I guess you'd probably refer to it.
Okay.
But.
Well, I thought that was pretty good. It's pretty concise. It's a lot to wrap up. There's a lot that happened in this book.
You know, in comparison to some of the other, writings of Asimov, it's like we really enjoyed the plot development, the character development. I think he was strides better in the whole storytelling aspect than some of the earlier Foundation efforts.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's actual character development, right? Like we get a sense of who these people are. It's not just like these major historical events that are framed with like a kind of myopic view from one character, right? The way it was described to me was that by a friend of mine was that basically it was kind of the first book was very much studying like societal trends or like different ideas that take hold throughout the development of a civilization, and the characters themselves were just kind of almost placeholders to describe how these things unfold and how they would play out in like a 10,000 foot view. I think that, as his writing has continued, and you can really tell that this is the writing of a mature writer as opposed to a guy fresh out of the military, he's been doing this a while, because he's been able to make us care about the characters. There's nuanced feelings going on, and the pacing is good. The pacing is excellent, right up to the end.
Yeah, I think that's very I think that's right on, and I think. The thing that's really the evolution of the writing is that, he started off, right, as you'll recall, the first three books were really done serialized in science fiction magazines, and then they were edited and turned into a book. But it's kind of like in that format, it's kind of like you ever seen movies that are made out of plays? Even with a big budget, they still look flat and they still look constrained, like they're on a stage, and
like very two-dimensional.
Yeah. And it's so even if they have the budget to kind of stitch in all sorts of landscape in between, it just feels like a very constrained kind of universe. And you can usually tell when that happens. And so, there was that component to the writing, and yes, indeed he was much younger and earlier in his career. Cause I think the first one was, appeared as a book in what was it, 1949 or thereabouts.
That sounds about right.
And then the third one was 1962, and he was, still writing, relatively, he was doing some provocative stuff, But the other thing was that this was also in the tradition of a literary epic, right? That you're looking at things across, you know, the opening promise is a swath of 1,000 years of humanity, right? The very first line of the first book is something written by the Galactic Encyclopedia in the year 1020 Foundation era. And then they immediately backpedal, and you get a sense in the first few pages that they're going to deal with the creation of the Foundation. And then you have this fact that, you know, the opening quote is the encyclopedia written by the winners 1,000 years later. And then this struggle comes in. So there's this whole idea of predestination and the battle of the gods that you get in like Greek mythology and those kind of epics. So it's really hard when you're writing an epic as a single, you know, sort of arc. It's really hard to do character development, even if you're mature as a writer. And so you go back to the old Greek stuff, and it's, you know Odysseus, and you know what he does, but you don't know what he thinks, what he likes, like that. So now, what's I think pivotal and important about Foundation's Edge is that he's setting up an architecture for an entire universe, but he's also telling a story. Otherwise, it would get like preachy, and you know, it wouldn't have been successful.
It'd be too abstract, right?
That's right, exactly.
You run into, you need to have a found, you need to, you know, it's like reading a textbook, mm-hmm. right? You're like, oh, you know, 10,000 lives were lost or whatever. And it like, it just becomes a statistic, right? There's no anchoring humanity behind it.
Yes, exactly. And so you have an actual story. And so this is a more modern sort of science fiction, you know, technique of world building. And then, you know, once you have this universe created, then you can drop stories within it that are a manageable scope. And so, you know, if you look at what I think is really a big positive, we can argue about the ending of Foundation's Edge, you know, whether it was really a satisfying ending or not. But the fact is that he's laying out all of these nuggets, and he really, I think, was very careful about doing this, of setting the stage to expand out the trilogy and then drop lots more stories in there. Mm-hmm. So he's unifying all of the worlds, the different timelines that he had previously written, including some of the world, you know, so he had the Foundation series, the Robot series, some of the other pre-Empire series, like the Stars Like Dust. And then he even tied in The End of Eternity, which is a standalone work, with some stuff that was very late in the book, with about a page worth of stuff. He dropped hints. He never picked that up, but he really went back, reread his stuff, and figured out a way to create a universe that ties everything together that he had done, and to have an architecture to tell stories very effectively after that, you know, which is a great business move as well as a good literary move.
I think you raised two points that I think are worth, you know, foot stomping here. The first one that I didn't even realize until you said it, Brent, but in the very beginning in the first Foundation book, Foundation, they do have these references to the Galactic Encyclopedia, right? Mm-hmm. And I have a small confession to make. Peter's going to be a little bit upset. In the search,
did you read ahead?
In the search for a good summary of the first four books, I did look at the beginning of our next endeavor, Foundation and Earth, to see if he had a handy one of those what's happened up till now kind of things. And he does have a prologue. Interestingly, the prologue is actually more about, it's more autobiographical, if you can believe it. He wrote basically a mini autobiography of his Foundation journey and adventure. And he talked about the first three books and how he started writing them. And he had this, his grand idea was basically a future story that was historical. So the whole idea was like telling the story as if it was like us reading Homer or the Iliad or something like that, right? That happened thousands of years ago, but from a future setting, so that those historical references of the 1,000-year, you know, version of the Galactic Encyclopedia are kind of central to that that idea that he had at the beginning. Then he then he mentions that.
So in other words,
he got like another. Oh, good. Go ahead.
So in other words, so he was talking about a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, sort of thing.
Can you believe it? Right.
Written by the Princess Alulian.
Irulan.
Irulan.
Peter.
Irulan.
So he also mentioned that he was like, you know, he was issuing these, all these stories were kind of sequential magazine published articles, if you will, you know, stories in sci-fi magazines through the first three books. I didn't realize that, but it was actually the full first three books were all independently released as sections, right? And it wasn't until 1961 or two that they were combined into a trilogy. And Asimov actually got no royalties for those books until the 80s. Like, he didn't get royalties on any of the Foundation books that sold from the late 40s through the late 70s. And then the whole reason he wrote Foundation's Edge was apparently because of the fanfare around his original trilogy. But he was struggling with it because he had kind of lost his interest in the Foundation idea, right? The Foundation series idea way back in the 50s and kind of given up on it for almost two decades, right?
Right. Because it wasn't making him any money.
Right, probably. So he started when he told the publisher about his quandary, they went out, they bought the rights to the old original books, and he started getting royalties on his original books. And they committed him to writing Foundation's Edge and then more books after that. But one fact of history that we were getting wrong in our previous episodes was that the Hugo Award was for Foundation's Edge, but it was actually a 1962 Hugo Award for the Foundation trilogy. And I think his claim to fame is that it was the only trilogy ever recommended for a Hugo Award. Everything's been individual novels or something like that.
Well, it was a special award. It was called the best science fiction series of all time or something. It was kind of like those,
right.
And those like Lifetime Achievement Oscars.
Right. And I don't think they've had that category since or something like that.
Correct.
Yeah.
You're saying that this whole book long, I've been conned into thinking that the ending must be coming because of the Hugo Award. Early.
To be fair, he won the Locus Award for Best Science Fiction Novel in 1983.
Right. And he also...
Was that for Foundation's Edge?
That was for Foundation's Edge.
And Foundation's Edge was the New York Times bestseller for something like 20 to 40 weeks or something like that.
Right. So it did win awards. We didn't...
It was lauded, if you will.
Yes.
Much lauded, yes.
Lauded, even.
Yeah.
Lauded and lauded.
Maybe in Florida, lauded.
Is it laud or loud?
It's laud.
Laud.
Brent, we have an English professor on our...
Although that is that is a Latin term, but it is lauded.
Lauded.
So, yeah, 3-1. Yet that's a losing score for Florida. Florida.
But what if
score another one for Florida elementary school education.
So is it magna cum laude?
Magna cum laude.
Cum laude. It's magna cum laude, I thought.
That's another language.
Yeah, I was an English major, not a Latin major.
Not a Latin major. What is in Sanskrit?
So, well, that's where my pronunciation comes from. So, in any case, there was another point, and I completely forgot what the other point was. But
that's how it's spelled, and that's how you spell it.
The historic reference and the references. Oh, yeah, and we don't have those anymore, right? We don't have the Galactic Encyclopedia references since like the end of the first book, which is a little, you know.
Oh, as a Dune person, you're like you got used to it.
Like, where are my quotes? Yeah, where are my historical quotes?
Well, it was also when we pointed out in the first season, not that I say we because I was not there, but it was pointed out about how there's sort of a little foreshadowing in those little quotes. So it gives you something sort of in the back of your head to think about while you're reading it through. And there's sort of like a guidepost a little bit in terms of what the chapter is going to cover and how it fits into stuff. So there's, you know, whether it was a narrative crutch because of his early on period, but I don't know, I didn't really miss him in this one, just because, like, kind of like we're talking about, he's just much more mature as a story writer. That, you know, it's not nearly as two dimensional.
You also don't have the time leaps, right?
Well, that's the other thing, right? There's some context when you're every section is 300 years ahead of the other section.
And it's also like a relic of the fact that it was a periodical release. I don't know how to say that, but it basically, you know, it was
serially released.
It was a serial, right? Yeah. And so then someone picks up the latest copy of, you know, Hugo magazine or whatever it is, awesome science fiction stories, January edition, right? And they haven't read it in 6 months. You know, you get reacclimated to the flavor of the story right away, mm-hmm. and then you go into it.
He also evolved though in the way he was, like, even in the first three books, right? We started off with these super tiny short snippets of story, and then a huge jump of time, and then it got a little bit longer, and then it was like a huge jump of time, and then it got a little bit longer. And by the end of the second book, he needed, like, he really probably could have taken the first half of the second book and the last half of the second book and the first half of the third book, and that was really like the mule, right? Mm-hmm. It was all the mule story. So it became more cohesive, if you will, the more he wrote about it, and it became also more, I don't want to say myopic, but it became more zoomed in on these moments in history for shorter periods of time, but more depth as far as like the human characters and the story and the interactions and things like that, rather than just the epic storytelling like the first couple of leaps we had. Like, what's your favorite old Asimov that you missed in Foundation's Edge?
I miss the shrill women.
Yeah, shrew women.
I miss the shrewish, awful women.
Yeah, I miss
one-dimensional women.
I mean, I would say I miss the sort of incompetent rulers, but it seems like there's plenty of those in the present.
One on every side.
Every single side has, like, just an overconfident, inept sort of, like, general. They're just not smoking as much as they used to.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I miss the
most. I do miss the ridiculous nucleic devices as my favorite old Asimov trope, right? Just because of how creative and also ridiculous that they are.
It was like the Jetsons meets the nuclear age, right?
Yeah. I
miss all the, everything nucleic. Like,
right. Nucleic. My nucleic pillow.
Yeah, nucleic pillows. nucleic paper.
Nucleic powered toothbrush.
Paper.
Nucleic
paper,
ashtray. It's
like, a whole ship full of nucleic trinkets, nucleic washing machines.
Nucleic
dishwashers,
puncher.
Yeah, nucleic puncher, nucleic puncher. Take goes through two men.
The idea that they conquered an entire, like, world of people with, you know, dishwashers that would break in 5 years.
Yeah, it would be short-lived, marginally outliving their warranty.
We'll never hear the end of it from our shrill wives.
Yeah, that's what it ties.
It's basically like Walmart come to town, right? That all of a sudden the dishwasher breaks in 5 years.
Right. Yeah,
right.
Got to go back to Walmart.
1 year after the warranty ends.
But they pulled up chocks and pulled Walmart out, right? So there's no more Walmart to get a new appliance.
Yeah,
and that's collapsed why everybody's
entire society.
In tatters, right? Their emotions are in tatters because they can't get their replacement from Walmart.
Well, so that's kind of how it. That's the Florida economy in a nutshell, isn't it?
That's fired.
Brent, what was your favorite old Asimov that you found lacking in Foundation's Edge?
You know, I think now this may be because I read the original, you know, when I first read it when I was like 12 or thereabouts and was, you know, not well calibrated on sort of cynicism and didn't have enough other, you know, sci-fi knowledge to really think about this. But I really kind of enjoy the epic sort of scale of this. And, you know, especially if you look at what went before. So if you go back to 20 years before the first Foundation book was written, the big sort of epic scale space opera work was the Lensman or the Skylark series by Doc Smith, written starting in the late 20s. You talk about shallow and lack of character, and you talk about goofy technology, when you consider it's almost 100 years ago, that has it in spades. It's really almost campy in terms of tone. And so, I think that the epic scale and the idea of this whole idea that you would be able to use technology to understand how life works is very appealing to a nerdy, preteen or, tweener. And especially as I was, interested in computers, and this is where I have to put on my old guy hat.
But to be fair, Brent, I was more than middle-aged by Peter's standards, at least, when I read Foundation for the first time, and I thought it was like a cool way to think about humanity and from this epic, zoomed out lens and little ants running around, building their society up from the ruins of a fallen empire. Like it was a cool idea. I think it was a good idea that he kind of let go of. And I think that's what when I was saying that I missed the references to the Galactic Encyclopedia, it was like, I'm with you. I kind of miss that epic scale and that kind of perspective on the story. We're just down in it with the people now. We're not looking from above like, giant aliens watching ants, live their lives in the ant farm.
Yeah, and it's, I think when you look at the, how Foundation's Edge comes in, it's like, the whole idea of the Selden plan in the first three books gives you this sense of comfort that there is fundamentally an orderly universe, even while this inconceivably vast galactic empire is busy imploding, that there is, order and sort of an inherent positive, direction in the universe. And that's a pretty reassuring thing. And then all of a sudden, Foundation's Edge comes along and says, hey, wait a minute, the Selden plan is too perfect. It can't possibly, especially after the mule, it can't possibly be working this way. And there's something, sort of the deck is being stacked somehow.
Something wrong in it being so right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Along the same lines, it's almost like I remember how I used to think of the second Foundation at the end of the first trilogy. And, throughout the season, we've been talking about how every week you're just like, man, this is the House of Cards,
These guys are the worst.
Yeah, these guys thought they were fantastic. And like the more you learn, you're like, wow, they're just like squabbling sort of. They're all these ascetic sort of long range thinking.
They're great, sleeping with the natives.
Great people and a beyond reproach with their judgment. And it's like, oh, yeah, he's just like, fighting at the table over nonsense. This is just
slumming it with the Hamish
people and just squabbling. It's just like, wow.
Jogging in the wilderness.
Yogging behavior. Yeah, but it's like the same thing. You thought last time, like Brent saying, like, oh, I think it was a order. And there was somebody was at the wheel and it was fine. You look out like, oh, that guy is a drunk womanizer at the wheel. And so it's not so orderly after all, who is driving this bus?
Comfort in the idea that there's a plan.
Yeah.
And that there's an adherence to the plan and there's somebody in charge.
Yeah.
Then
you find out that Sunday Bay is the first speaker.
Now at the end of Foundation's Edge, it's like all parties are just like, I'm pushing these buttons. I'm pushing all these buttons, right? They think they're doing stuff and they're not doing anything,
That's exactly it, right? You're descending. It's almost like the transition between the original Star Trek series and Star Wars just a handful of years later, right? That the Star Trek universe, the outside, you never had to take the Enterprise through a starship wash, right? It never got dirty. It never, they didn't have the budget to actually have,
uniforms. Stuff. Immaculate. Well,
nobody like, there was minimal visible blood unless it was, causing Shatner to have to take his shirt off, and show off and
nary a wrinkle on that uniform. Perfectly pressed, all of them, all of the time.
Right. And there was not, you know, like junk left in the hallways on the Enterprise or anything. And then you move to Star Wars less than a decade later. And this was a universe that had been not only lived in, but had been beaten up. Right.
It's not, like, not necessarily well taken care of. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the, you know, the Millennium Falcon was obviously had, you know, two bachelors living in it. Right. You can just imagine the Hot Pocket wrappers, you know, piled up behind the
right, exactly, and one of them's made of hair.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's cans of cat food, empty cans of cat food.
You can imagine
the hall.
The shower drain on the Millennium Falcon is probably not the most orderly.
That's what it is. We talked about that in one of the earlier episodes. It's like I just imagine like two dudes like living in basically the size of a living room for several months, like. Just the smell of humanity.
Kellerad and, you know.
And they talk about it.
Trev.
In Foundation's Edge. He goes into it, actually. I think we you called it, Peter. This is like another contention for the Prescience Award. But you were talking about how the spaceship must stink. And I think two or three chapters later, Asimov digs right into it.
Right,
talks about the world sense and all that. We had our whole world sense conversation.
Right, right. Well, it's like, you know, have you ever like traveled in the car with somebody like, and they're like, they just like crack open a Chobani yogurt and they like crush it. And then you're like, what are you going to do with that? Like, you didn't lick that thing clean.
Right.
There's going to be hot yogurt in this car for the next 6 hours.
Or like a peanut butter and banana sandwich.
Yeah, it's just like a banana peel.
Like
turning black slowly.
Yeah, it's like a guy putting a fish in the microwave.
Right, exactly. Like fish in the microwave at work.
That's great. Thanks, buddy.
That's the real reason Jason left Connecticut, by the way.
Yes,
Brent. We've been meaning to tell you.
I felt oppressed. I like eating fish at lunch, and I was not allowed to put it in the microwave at work. So I felt like cultural oppression.
Olfactory discrimination.
Not a problem.
I did remember the second point that I had, by the way, from your earlier comments, Brent.
Yeah.
And they also relate to me confessing about reading ahead, because Asimov at the end, it reminded me of Asimov at the end of Foundation's Edge has like an epilogue where he talks about all of the references that you mention, Robot series, the Empire series, and the Stardust thing that you said, but it's like an ad campaign for, you can go out and buy these 15 to 20 other books and send me, you know, more of your money. Like kind of thing. I just thought it was like shameless, absolutely shameless plugging for selling more books, you know.
He's working harder to keep your money.
Yeah. So I think you're right. He was strategic. And I mean, he's clearly
he was mad
seasoned,
about losing that foundation money.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that there is a backdrop for that because, you know, these days, if you're an aspiring science fiction writer, you're not going to sell a book without having the story arc for multiple sequels already figured out and probably having them, you know, at least treatments done for them. Because, you know, they're trying to de-risk their business by, you know, having a proven concept or a proven universe that people would like to hear more stories from. And, you know, the authors have a name for it. They call it world building. And that really wasn't done. And it probably really coincides with around the early 80s when Foundation's Edge was written.
You touched on it earlier about the ending. It's like sort of an ending, but it's almost not really. It's almost like a beginning.
It's
so like you're just waiting for the – and it's like, well, I'll tune in next time as our heroes X, Y, and Z. But that's kind of the – you know, it's like every movie's like that nowadays. Yeah. You know,
it's like they do with
Marvel. They're just like, well, this is somewhat of a resolve, but there's no finality to it because – we got more merchandise, you know.
I want to talk to you about the Avengers initiative, Dan.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's like, how would
there's
you
no money in there's no money in ending the series. There's just more money in prolonging the series.
Right. And you know, you can do it well, right? That you can certainly do it badly, and plenty of people have, but you can do it well. The Marvel guys have really done it with just about everything. And you would be deeply disappointed these days if you exited a Marvel movie and there wasn't a post-credit scene.
Yeah, I mean, but I would settle for something a little bit funny, not necessarily a teaser of what's going to come next.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's a little bit, it is a little bit lame.
Well, but that's part of the skill is stringing somebody along while not making them feel like they're being strung along, right?
I believe it's called flirting.
Sure. Sort of. Isimov's, but
will they? That's
old Isimov. I'm talking about old Isimov there.
You mean predatory?
True. I guess if you wanted to flirt, you would need female characters. So it's probably not old Isimov to be truly, truly hewing to it. But yeah, I mean, that's part of the, it's like to feel like you have been given and paid off, but at the same time, not fully wrapping things up. You know, there's a skill to that, to where you let people down and want them to come back, but not doing it begrudgingly. Like, oh God, I didn't get any payoff at the end of this book. There's some payoff, but at the same time, there's some more to come.
I thought you were going to go straight to the kill with that one, and it didn't happen in this book.
Well, it's Foundation's Edge. That's, you know, right in the title. Yeah. Should have known the beginning.
We're still on the edge.
Not complete.
Should have known from the start. It was always going to beat her out at the end.
But, no, I mean, it ended up, you know, working though, right? That people did go back and they read The Naked Sun and The Caves of Steel and, mm-hmm. you know, which were not originally written to be part of this, you know, expanded universe. And they went back and read some of the juveniles, the Stars Like Dust. And I think that's the one. They read some of it, which he wove into this as well. And why not? You know, there's,
yeah, I mean, it could be fun. I had my own journey with Herbert because I really loved Herbert's writing and I read all kinds of stuff that he wrote. But standalone stuff in addition to series, you know, or mini series that he had put out. But I thought it was hilarious, just like so, you know, so naked in his presentation of his desire to sell more books. So not to reel us back to the book at hand, but there's a lot of new Isimov here as well. And just like our favorite old Isimov that we're missing, Dan, maybe you've been pretty quiet. Yawning in the background there. Do you have any new Isimov that you'd like to highlight? Favorite or unfavored?
My favorite new Isimov is the character depth I like a lot. I like that, you know, the other part of it, and it kind of ties back, we talked about before, it's a little unfair to characterize it that way, because it's very hard to make character depth up when you're only in the book for 10 pages at a time, like because of the stop start nature and the periodicity of it. We talked about, it's very hard to have a character arc when there's not enough time to really do all that. So, you know, we had talked about favorite characters and it's almost like a vignette. You get a vignette with a character. It's like I used to talk about Lathan Devers, my favorite character, but his story arc is basically like he rescues the guy. He with this trinket salesman, and then at smash cut, he like dies in a salt mine 7 years later. Like
off stage, he dies.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like 80. It's yeah, like, you're writing about. Yeah, he died. Oh yeah, he died like 80 years ago in the salt mines.
Salt mine.
Rocket
prison.
Exploded on the way back to his home planet. Type of situation. Right. Like literally, like oh, and he's dead off camera.
My favorite new Isimov is he has a lot of very relevant inventions as of 81 or whenever he wrote this, right? So he forecasts, you know, lifelike robots, Wikipedia, the internet. What else did he invent in this book?
A wafer thin.
He invented like haptic feedback with the computer interface, right?
I still love the idea that the computer like has to like make you feel like it's working really hard.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's it's like
the wheels are turning. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Those really hard drives spinning. They're spinning, they're spinning.
It's like physically demanding just to like pilot it.
Exactly. I don't know if I want the thing controlling my hyperspace jumps to like be spewing out fumes.
You know, he doesn't quite perfect it, but he actually takes a go at functional technology, like technology that enables like the story and the actions, whereas before it was like, you know, they're just like jumping across the universe and it's all like, oh, we just like kind of look at this 3D viewer and then all of a sudden we're exactly where we need to be. And he actually goes a little bit further and tries to like create real technology in his story now.
Yeah, so, I mean, I really want them to pan out
how you could get like a faster than light newspaper across the universe. Picks up the paper, like, the empire has fallen.
Peter, we solved that problem. The hyperfax, remember?
The hyperfax. They've gotten a hold of the radios.
Right.
Control all the propaganda. There's one radio station for the entire universe, and they have control.
And I think instead of calling it faster than light, you called it faster than life. And I think that's a much better way to
describe
it. That's
even better.
I think the one radio station would be, a successor to today's streaming services, Pandora Galactica.
Fantastic.
Every song ever possible to invent is in there.
It directly beaming into my brain all at once.
And is the AI of the system also projecting the new songs that are being written as you're listening? Because of I'm thinking of the universe map that is anticipating the birth of stars. Like the AI of the system that has all the songs in it is also writing the new songs that people are writing simultaneously in anticipation.
It's like an Ouroboros.
Their art happening. Yeah.
Does it know exactly what song I want to hear at any given moment?
So the good news is I followed you, Jason. The bad news is it was not funny.
So I want to go back to, well, first of all, Brent, what's your favorite part of New Isimov?
You know, I think it was really the whole setup to the final thing, right? That you actually had politics in the second foundation, you know, that you actually had some tension. And in the earlier books, if we had shown the 12 speakers at the table for the second foundation, they would all have gotten along. There wouldn't have been any undercurrents of personal ambition that would get in the way of the mission.
Right.
And so that really sets up a lot more different ways for the story to go. You kind of felt that in the first three books, the whole concept was on rails, essentially. And, you know, certainly for the first book and a half until the mule showed up. But here it's like, okay, we start looking at the political situation in Terminus, and you realize that the first foundation is, you know, it's got millions of star systems under its hegemony, and, you know, there's got to be politics. So the mayor is really a big operator, and so there are going to be political factions, even though the Selden plan ultimately has theoretically taken all of that into account. And so it's nice to see, you know, real life. You know, there's real disputes, there's real politics, there's maneuvering, there's backstabbing.
Now, I got a question for you that's a follow-up, and it's kind of it relates to a conversation that we had earlier in the season. And I'm reading between the lines of what you just said, and I want to know if I'm right or not. So my impression is that there was no politicking in the second foundation until the mule hit. And it was nice to see that there actually was politicking, or that it was there the whole time. Or do you feel like this was kind of like a reveal of the state of the affairs of the second foundation?
I think it was, you know, it was getting some dirty laundry out there, right? Okay. That if you look at Preem Palver, you know, the first speaker who's doing field work there, he's not getting in arguments with his underlings very much. There doesn't seem to be, you know, he's in conflict with the mule, but there's not, you know, he doesn't have to bludgeon into line opposing factions who are gunning for his job.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so the politicking wasn't there.
Well, they mentioned it in the book. They talk about, the impeachment comes out. It's like, in 500 years, it's only happened three times, some comically small amount of times. It's not like it's like, you know, it's not like this sort of like ongoing feud. It seems like this is the exception. We kind of talked about that. So look, is this just indicative of this particular table, or is this just the way the Second Foundation's acting the whole time?
It was almost weak enough to just be a literary device to hype up, you know, the importance of this moment in the story. It's like, there was some headbanging, but that's a minor sort of tangible detail compared to the the plotting of speaker, the female speaker, Delarmy.
Yeah, that brings up a good point that I wanted to bring up in the podcast anyway. There's like zero consequences to Delarmy. And we never really found out who set up the possible assault.
Exactly. Whatever happened to her.
I think that was the Gaians, right? Because Novi is a Gaian, and they knew where she was. And they, you know, the Gaians had to do something to get, you know, Gendibal or Gendibal onto a ship and go try to figure out, you know, that there's something going on.
So like a super toxic, like I'm going to put you in a dangerous situation and then rescue you. So we bond scenario.
Yep. So he lets his guard down.
Peter, Brent, I tried to tell Peter over and over again that Novi is super sus, like highly suspect.
I said, I agreed with
you. Peter
insisted that no, he could tell she was there. He just couldn't tell that she was female.
No. All right. So that's what you said and what I said are two different things. I disagreed with you about his ability to notice her.
I also agreed
that she was highly suspect.
That's why she was suspect. I remember listening back,
Jason. You were right. Reading back is very, very poignant about it. Like, oh yeah, well, she just appeared, you know. Like she's not like she was there, but they didn't notice her. It's like she clearly had some sort of skill.
And clearly comes through in the end.
But what does happen to Delarmy? We never found out, right?
And it's like, you know, oh, that
might not have caused that scene, but she was still. She was still probably evil, you know, differently. She might not have done all the things. She might not have set up the whole table deal.
Right?
Yes. What's the difference?
She's from Slytherin House, okay? That doesn't mean necessarily that she's evil.
But maybe it's opening the door. Seemed pretty
non-redeemable character to me anyway, but maybe that's just me. You want to talk about how much you miss the shrews? That's the closest you get
If you're waiting for your boss to retire for like 20 years when he was all toasty and overdue to retire, you'd be pretty mad when some young upstart comes in and tries to like take your thunder. Like that dude hasn't done his dues. I'm like the only female speaker here and I have chops to be number two. And then this like arrogant loser comes in who goes out jogging and isn't interested in like
dating anybody. A spaceship. Yeah. The dude can't even control a spaceship.
Doesn't even smoke, the guy.
Doesn't even smoke.
He yogs. He doesn't have no nucleics to speak of. Yes, I take your point.
He almost gets beat up by a big Hamish.
I'm shocked that Isimov has a glass ceiling. Really shocked. To Brent's point,
I wonder if we're opening up the door for something like what we saw in Star Wars with the Sith, right? Like this dark side of the second foundation, right? Dark side of the table, right? Could there start to be kind of a divergence of those ascetic kind of like selfless types and they just get like steamrolled by the Delarmys at the table. And then she says, I don't even need you guys. I'm going to go do my own thing. And find another character because we've got to have two, right? And Isimov is big about the twos. He sends two people out in a spaceship. He's got the main person and their main backup, you know, Codel and Novi and Gendibal.
Pelerad and Trevise.
And then, you know what I mean,
twos.
Picking the story apart, too. Marlon Brando didn't like.
Wasn't in the first book, was he?
No, she was. That's what we've been affectionately calling the mayor of Terminus.
Harlan Brando is Marlon Brando.
Harlan Brando, totally.
Manny Brando.
Ronnie Mando.
Brando Calrissian.
Brando.
That's a totally different guy. Rando. Yeah.
Ronnie Towles has. She like had a
the mayor from South Park.
Shift.
Yes, her.
She had a hard character shift, like going from like this years of being a conniving like backroom, you know, operator. I like the word operator that Brent introduced.
Yes, very apropos.
Yeah, And it also implies murder, which I also enjoy. That to like all of a sudden, I'm a woman of action. I got to get there on the scene.
Like, who are you?
With my shadowy lieutenant who turned out to not have anything to do with anything, you know.
The mustachioed lieutenant who right. smokes a pipe.
Yeah, with his great mustache.
What's the character's name from from James Lionel. Bond?
Lionel. Oh, which one? Short
round? No. That's short round. Odd job.
Odd job.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Short round is Indiana Jones. So close.
I was going to call him Short Stack.
Random task.
Yeah, I brought like Random Task from Moss and Powers. That was
that
a good
one. Really hurt.
Who throws a shoe?
Who throws a shoe?
Honestly.
Speaking of 90s.
Also, before you cut you off, did you have a point?
We never got any, like, I felt like we never got any resolution on that either. Right?
Fidel.
Yeah, because it was just a hard shift.
Well, speaking of, if you're going to take the pros, Jay, you were hard on Cadell the whole time.
He was going to be the second foundationer who's sitting there in the background. He was going to be my what was the princess's name?
Lady Jessica,
Callie, yeah. I think it was.
Lady Callie. Thank you, Brent. Ooh, Brent.
Deep cut.
Deep cut.
Sometimes a man twirling a mustache is just twirling a mustache. There's no.
Sometimes he's just trying to make his points.
Just trying to make his mustache bigger. It's all
trying to make those points nice and tight. There's like Salvador Dali.
No evil plot afoot.
Yes, he doesn't actually have much to do in the whole, you know, arc, but it's still interesting when you realize that the mayor of the Terminus has got a goon squad.
Oh yeah.
You know, has got a skullcracker.
Yeah. She's definitely like a tyrant of sorts, right?
Yeah.
That's the impression that I've gotten.
How could you not? It's not like a soft touch you really could have, you know?
Yeah.
You got to imagine there's some Machiavellian nature you have to. Exactly.
I mean, I think that's also our modern cynicism creeping mm-hmm. in. Part of the appeal of having like a Harry Seldon is essentially you have a father figure that has like plotted out the future. And you know that everything's going to be okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, it's almost like we've been told that story, and that was the story for the first trilogy, which I'm almost treating as a separate series, right? Because mm-hmm. of the time gap, the difference between the characters, and then this is kind of like the reveal that Dad is dead, right? And that there isn't someone at the wheel. And, you know, it's time to grow up almost. Like, you have to take control of your own destiny. And then we take it, and we throw that role into the hands of a new character. And ultimately, this guy has to decide the fate of the universe, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, by the way, I would say the thing that's more comforting about the first three Foundation books, especially if you're sort of a kid, teenager or whatever, nerdy teenager, is that it's the mathematics. It's not Seldon himself, because he dies,
right away.
Pretty much after his trial, he's done, right? That, you have the time vault, have him showing up, in video a couple of times, but it's the equations that make it all, that in a way that's more hopeful, because then it's not going to be corrupted by politics.
Right.
So then all of a sudden you now get into book four and it starts with politics in the Foundation. And then it starts with politics erupting at the speaker's table when Jindabal's late to the meeting. And it's all about, that even though the plan is still working, it may not be enough.
Right. It's interesting. The idea of this is from Contact, right? The Jodie Foster movie from mm-hmm. the mid-90s, right? The way that they get in touch with the aliens is not through a language, so to speak. They get to, they communicate with each other through like numbers, because even though numbers are arbitrary, essentially like one does not necessarily mean it's going to be one every time, we decided to call the concept of one the number one, right? But it's still universal, right? There's one object, there's two objects, there's three objects, and you can add and multiply those things together and then communicate with people across, you know, when language might not exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I get it. There's comfort in the numbers, right? There's a formula that you can apply and the math will work out the same every time, and you can account for drift or statistical anomalies, and you know, it's another like version of like repackaging that hope, right? Mm-hmm. The hope that we'll figure it out.
But now the ultimate choice that Trevis makes is that there's going to be politics. You know, you're going to have the third foundation way, which involves some possibility of adjustment. And then the question becomes, well, who's doing the adjusting? You know, well, you're back in the same discussion again.
Thank God the robots step in and tell us to make a decision.
So there's a plea of the fifth on behalf of our character Bliss, right? She neither confirms nor denies the accusation, but it's pretty obvious, right? Like there's no way that story about like the Eternals or whatever, figuring out the course for humanity. They're almost like a surrogate for Selden at a higher level in the human journey. Right. But I mean, how could this planet kind of sustain itself without a guiding hand, right? If there was no guiding hand, it would be more like the first or second foundation. It wouldn't be this harmonious kind of, you know, notional utopia.
Well-oiled machine. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so, it would just be like another colony. It'd be like, you know, Calgan.
Right. But is that good? Is that better? Like, you know, I think I'm still, every time, you know, the more we read in this series, the more I'm like, you know, is this just a melodrama of the like toxic necessity of
an authority figure?
Yeah, authority trying to make plans for humanity that are not best for them necessarily, but they have to somehow navigate. It's just like, it feels like this very dead-endish kind of angle
this
that
is,
we're
this-
on.
This sounds like your rebellious inner child coming out right now,
probably,
Jason.
Probably.
Would you want to talk about that some more on our podcast?
Maybe after, but not for a general audience.
Just when it's getting real, Jason shuts it down. How about you, Brent? Let's talk about your inner child.
Oh, man. I already spend enough time with my own therapist doing that. Fortunately, I got really good insurance, but It's interesting because in a way this discussion about, you know, is this, so now that Trevis has chosen Galaxia, is this in fact better? Well, that gets explored further down in the series.
Yeah, I would imagine, right? We got what, four more books that we got to tackle.
Yeah, there's also some good ones that were written by. You know, the estate, and there were authorized sequels that were written by some other folks that are actually pretty good that really explore, you know, where did psychohistory come from? Because it was sort of a fait accompli in the beginning of the first book.
It's already established and then lost to time, essentially. Right.
Yeah. And it's just sort of a premise that you accept that all of this happened. And it's interesting that there are several of the volumes really look at Selden's life and how he finally came to the aha moments that were the catalyst for all of the psychohistory.
Did it involve a strange rendezvous with a woman named Bliss?
unfortunately not. And by the way, I'm not giving anything away because I don't believe it's actually answered later, It's not a done deal that she's a robot. She never cops to it in the book, and it is not a done deal, and it is not necessary for that to be resolved for the story to move forward.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it is necessarily. I just like that, like the, you know, You didn't eat with us.
Cooler, it'd be cooler if she was.
You didn't eat with us. It'd be a lot cooler if she did.
Cooler if you did.
So, you know, we typically ask, you know, like which characters, like, would you associate with? I think I'd like to get off of that rail a little bit and go on.
Why even bring it up then?
Because I'd like to do a variation on the theme there. And I'd like to ask you if you could be like good friends and hang out with any of the characters in this book, which one would you latch on to? Which one would you want to be friends with and hang out with?
Bliss, because I'm a very lonely man.
Bliss is nice just because, like, she's just there to help. Above board, she'll probably be very friendly and make you dinner and, you know, like, help you
and
out.
She doesn't
If you're of another persuasion, there's other things she can do for you as well. Like, everybody else in the book is, like, you know, taking stuff off the table, you know, carrying out their own, like, you know, I'm the main character of the story and I'm doing this because I'm awesome. And it's just, like, tiresome to, like, be, like, you know, second banana to some of these. Like, you talked about Cadell, like, he just sits in the background while Brandon makes ridiculous decisions, like, one after the other. So it's like,
I'm gonna go out on my own and save the universe.
Like, oh yeah, it's fantastic. Here we go again, you know.
I mean, maybe Novi, because she's...
Novi's probably, exactly, because she seems like there's a lot there that's unexplored, you know.
She's like a genuine character.
Well, she's, yeah, exactly.
She can help you move a couch, you know.
Yeah, if you want to open a twist off, that's not a twist off, she's right. Your person.
I got jars to open, you know.
But yeah, everybody else is just like, really? It sounds like a drag.
Exactly. Like, can you imagine being stuck on a ship of agenda ball?
Yeah. Just like every one of them is just like, nope.
I would smother that second speaker.
What's his name? Mun Lee. Yeah, might be. What's his name on the professor on the
traitorous almost second foundationer?
Yeah, near the second foundation. SQ.
Yeah, that was Mun Lee, right? Yeah,
Mun Lee. He was interesting enough. Maybe
he can at least weave a tale that I can.
The guy professor that they saw on Seychelles.
Yeah, I mean, you're supposed to pick one.
But these are like ancillary characters.
So pick one.
My point is, my favorite character is every. No, but my point
is.
I have
no favorite character.
I have no. They're all ancillary characters, except for the Novi. It's like, I wouldn't like any of the main characters because they're. I would like Dom. He's seems kind of cool.
Yeah, Dom seems tight, right?
Yeah, that seems like a good hang. That was my initial thought. So if I had to guess one, that would be my name. It would be Dom.
Yeah, Dom seems like a chill, hippie vegan type that, like.
Yeah, it's a big basket.
Yeah, he would be like the dude, right? And he would hand me like a. Exactly. A mudslide or a white Russian.
But I like Dom too, because, you know, it's aspirational, right? He's 92 and still trucking along.
Right. Hanging out with Bliss.
It's like Treebeard. Seems like a good hang.
Treebeard. But yes.
It's funny that I, in rereading this now at this point in my life, I actually identified with and wouldn't mind being Pelerat. Right.
Okay. I mean, fair.
The guy was the equivalent of a medieval studies major and he ends up with a hot younger chick.
Nice.
You know,
what about you, Jason?
I have to say, it's funny that you mentioned Pelerat, because in my mind, you know, if I think of who would I want to, like, spend time with, I think Pelerat would be the most enjoyable person to spend time with, because he actually has, like, a passion and he cares about it and he has interesting things to talk about, his, you know, his interests. And it would be cool to learn from, you know, somebody who's put that kind of time and dedication into learning so much about something they find important. And if I had to be on that spaceship with Trevise, I'd probably, you know, we'd be like gritting teeth at each other every 2 minutes. But if it was with Pelerat, I think I could survive it. You know, I can be difficult to live with. So I think, you know, somebody like Pelerat, I'd need somebody who's, you know, chill like that to
chill.
Deal with my quips and quibbles.
Jason, you're having a tough time with the spaceship. Let me, I'm just going to go to my room for a little bit. Chill out.
Peruse his wafer. Is that what they call it nowadays?
Well, wrestling with the controls. Yeah.
Pretty much. And say what's on the wafer.
So, you know, we didn't give awards. I would have to say that after listening back, there were a significant amount of near hits on all three of our parts, Dan, Peter, and myself.
Yeah, it was pretty even this season.
It was pretty even. So, you know, I think the one award that I would like to give out is probably the Such Nerds Podcast Slowest Editor Award.
You're also the fastest editor.
I'm just both the fastest
and the slowest. So it's very impressive.
The best summarizer goes to
yes,
Dan. Most number of microphones hit. I think probably goes to Jason podcast. This season.
Yes.
Whereas Dan has been dethroned from previous seasons.
Yeah. No. Bonk. Keep my hands to myself.
Yeah, Dan, you remain the best. The best newest member of the podcast.
Yes,
the most alive
third podcast host.
Barely.
For now.
I would like to highlight, Peter, to your point, for the first returning guest co-host award ever granted on the Such Nerds podcast. And Brent, we would like to grant that award to you.
Yeah. Well, I am deeply honored, and you know, as long as it doesn't sort of morph into one of those guests that like used to go on Johnny Carson when the original guest fell through, who was kind of a washed up C-list kind of guy, you know, Soupy Sales or one of those guys that was always in town.
Hardly, Brent. Hardly.
Never.
I think that's all we got for tonight, gentlemen. Once again, Brent, thank you so much for coming on the podcast again.
Well, thank you for having me back. It just goes to show that time does heal all wounds.
Yeah, and maybe we'll have enough time elapsed that Jason can fully recover from all the editing he's going to have to do.
Yeah.
Well, I need to finish editing before we start reading our next novel. But what are we reading next, Peter?
We're reading Foundation and Earth.
All right.
Is our next book on the season 5 of the Such Nerds podcast.
We'll tune in next time when Jason's editing forearm is gigantically massive compared to his other forearm.
From all the time spending with his all
that editing work that's being done.
All right. Well, tune in at an indeterminate amount of time to the Such Nerds podcast season 5. I have been your host for tonight, Peter, along with
Jason from Florida.
And Dan from Los Angeles.
And Brent from Connecticut.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Well, thank you for coming. And we'll see you guys next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.
All right. Love you guys. See you next season.
I think it's a man.